Bear and Laura King. We had some issues from our last hearing that we had asked them to come back with some more information about. Can't remember what that was, but I think you know. It's not on my cheat sheet.
I think they were your questions, Madam Chair.
I know they were my questions, so they were great questions.
Madam Pappas, Linda Baer, Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State College and Universities. Yes, we have the questions, and I will begin with the first set of questions. One had to do with Min Online, and the question had to do with how many students are taking courses solely online and not on a campus, and so we went and explored that. We actually have about 30% of our online students taking courses solely online.
Oh.
So of the online, which is about 7.5%, of all of our students right now, about 30% are solely online.
And those are are those mostly part-time then?
Right. Yes, Senator Pappas. And actually, back to numbers, about 42,000 students are online, so a third of that. So we're talking 10,000 or so that would be on that. Actually, my number is about 7,600 when I see it now in my numbers, so. Greater percentage of students are taking courses solely online now. They're moving more towards that, which would be a function of more courses being available. Since 2005, numbers of students taking courses solely online increased about 88%. So we're just seeing increases in that number. And that's the answer to the Min Online question.
Okay.
Second, we had a question regarding program review, and the question had to do with how many programs are within that dynamic cycle of being opened or closed or suspended. So for as of the 2006 year, we had about 76 programs closed. We had redesign close in a category that lists about 84 programs, and we had about 108 that were suspended. Suspension is the ability for a campus to come forward and suspend a program for upwards of 3 years while they determine whether to redesign or actually close. It also gives them a chance to work students through the pipeline to complete.
Can you give us some examples of the types of things you've closed and what you've decided to redesign and maybe what's suspended?
Chair Pappas, yes, I can. I have a number of examples here in relation to sometimes it has to do with the marketing and how much the field may need a course again. I've got things like tool dye and mold making diploma that was closed at Alexandria. I would have a legal office assistant or a payroll certificate. So these are certificates and diplomas and degrees. So sometimes these are very short programs. I would have things like painting and drywall finishing as a certificate. Others include construction electricity, residential light construction. Now, that could have been that at the diploma level, this happened to be one that was being offered at the White Earth Reservation, so the cohort was no longer there for that program. We have many of them in the trades, electronics, and basic masonry, for example. So those are some of the examples. Most of them appear to be more at the technical college and
are
at
they,
the certificate level.
The technology has changed, like in the printing industry, the technology has changed, or there's an oversupply of workers in that area, or what are some of the reasons why you end up closing programs?
Chair Pappas, it's an ongoing dynamic of things. One, it often will be that the pipeline's dried up, that there is not a need anymore for those graduates at that level. And so at some point it may be that a certificate is no longer needed, but the field needs the diploma or something of longer length. So most of it is market demand or that the industry is changing.
And what kinds of things then are you do redesign? What does that mean?
Chair Pappas, we have redesign in some of our languages, and so that probably is a revamping of how we're teaching some of the languages and determining that, or if, in fact, there may be alternative delivery mechanisms for some, and I have that. For example, I have Winona State in front of me. with a redesigned clothes category under business education, under many of their teaching categories, because they are studying and revamping how they're approaching some of their education degrees. And so that gives you some example at that point of what's going on, and we have several pages of examples.
Well, I mean, why would you suspend a program and to think about it? What would be a reason for doing that?
Chair Pappas, at some point it may be that redesign is required and they need to go to a national association that's well-known in where that field may be going, so that they may be studying. They may need to do some professional development on behalf of faculty for those purposes. And so stopping out for the time being may be the best thing to do. In other cases, it may be that there was a slump in the economy in relation to that degree, and they want to make sure that that's pretty certain that it's going to stay in that place.
Are there questions? Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, as long as we have them, and I should have contacted them with this question, but you know, in the news lately, there's been the issue of students from other states who are going to some northern Minnesota community colleges. And it says that they're receiving work-study programs and maybe some scholarships or grants. They're apparently coming mainly for athletics. I know that it's not legal to give them athletic scholarships, but I would kind of like a clarification with what non-resident students are able to receive in the scholarship or work study program, so that they get the aid with their tuition. I'm trying to understand that.
Senator Pappas and Senator Roebling, we would be happy to bring that information to you. We find work study, for example, for any of our students to be very beneficial, because it increases the engagement of students with mentors and with people that can care more about their success in school. But I can bring the information to you certainly about out-of-state and the opportunities both at our two-year campuses and our universities.
Okay, thank you.
Are there many campuses taking advantage of the Minscu provision that allows international students to pay resident tuition if they do community service?
Chair Pappas, yes, there are many that are taking advantage of that. We didn't come prepared at this point to answer that question.
So next time we have
next
more
time
questions
we can,
to answer.
We'll do that.
All right.
Yes, and again, that helps our communities, because when they are doing community service, it means they are out many times in our school districts talking about different countries, different cultures, different perspectives, which really assists our school districts.
I know Dr. Romali told me that they do that at Winona State.
Yes, yes. Chair Pappas, the last question I had was about reading from Senator Roebling, and we are here to report that the question was, what is the system doing in response to the 2005 legislation relating to improvement of reading instruction for students in teacher preparation programs? And the answer has to do with all colleges and universities approved by the Board of Teaching to prepare persons for classroom teaching licensure must include in their teaching preparation programs research-based best practices in reading consistent with the Section 122A.06, Subdivision 4. So that's the language. And the board, what we have done in response to that is all institutions approved by the Board of Teaching to recommend individuals for licensure were required to submit information to the Board of Teaching verifying their efforts to meet these requirements. Syllabi, topics, and assessments were included for each program for every institution. And these were reviewed then by outside panel of reading teachers and two teacher education faculty. So material was presented that enhanced the reading and reviewed by the outside panel to make sure that it was meeting the criteria. One specific response by our universities was the addition of reading in the content areas course requirement for all secondary majors. So we're talking about both elementary as well as secondary.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there any members of the Board of Trustees here today? I just wanted to see if there was anyone here. I wanted to introduce you. Okay, great, thanks.
Madam Chair, the other question that we left you with last week had to do with energy guidelines. Mm. You, I think, particularly had asked what are our standards for energy conservation right. in our both our construction program and in our operations program. I'd like to send the whole committee a more complete answer, but I want to give you a little overview of the answer here today. In our design standards, which are the standards by which we supervise all of the building construction and remodeling that we're fortunate enough to receive funding for, we have in those standards worked to make sure that the resulting building exceeds the state design standards by at least 30% for energy code. So we have set our floor 30% above the state's basic code. This applies both to materials and construction and our goal of yielding a construction quality that has a 30 to 50 year life. We also, in our standards, set a floor for the building roof quality of a light exceeding the state standard by 12 to 30%. You've heard, I think, Mr. Johnson testify about our roof program. We've been systematically, with your help and funding through the HEPR program, working through all the roofs that we have in inventory. And our design standards for them have been set high for long lives. We have, since 1995, 38% of our existing academic roofs have been built with these new roof standards. We also, in our design standards, have matched all the critical building components since the late 1990s to the LEED standards, as well as the University of Minnesota Sustainable Design Guidelines and the B3 legislation. So as the industry have changed, we have changed our standards to keep up with them. The other thing that we do that you might hear folks talk about is we require all substantial new buildings to go through a commissioning review, and that's intended to assure us that the equipment and design expectations that we thought we were building got built. And so we review every building to make sure it functions properly within a year of its opening. And since 2000, all projects have gone through that review. I also would just add that another strategy that we've employed that's been very effective is the installation of energy management systems, electronic energy management systems, at all of our campuses. And we've worked our way through 60% of the campuses now and have installed these systems, which control temperature throughout the campus through a zone management process and through the management of the air handlers. We will send you a more complete an extended answer to that question, Madam Chair, but I wanted to just give you a brief answer here today.
Well, you know, we've been having a lot of hearings on global warming and climate change, and so it would be interesting to know, I don't know if you can do this, to see if you are, what I think the term of art might be, climate neutral. If, you know, when you build a new building, if there are enough offsets in terms of the HEPRA that you end up not contributing to any more greenhouse gases.
I can't answer that question, Madam Chair. We do know that
I think that might be
making progress
down the pipe with the state.
On our roofs is the single largest contributor to energy conservation because the roofs are such an important part of the building system. So that's why it's been such a high priority for us over these last 10 years now.
Okay, great. Do you want to you ready to move on?
Ready to move on.
All right. Great. I think you were just going to talk briefly about the requests, and President Frank going to do that, and then we'll start working through the initiatives.
We're going to start with Senator Cohen's bill.
Oh, we are?
Yep, and three folks are going to speak to both Senator Cohen's bill.
Okay, great. Senator, do we want Senator Cohen up there?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Not speaking about briefly about the requests. Do I know what's going on?
The motions.
Senator Cohen, Senate File 581, the inflation. This seems like a good topic for you.
I was going to say thank you, Madam Chair, members. My first term in the Senate, I reworked good
first.
Parts of the criminal code, and then I segued from that into authoring all of the. Major court reorganization administration legislation. This is my inflation era,
yeah.
I guess, in the state Senate. So the legislation is a simple one. It asks for the appropriation to the Minsky system to reflect $57 million to cover inflationary costs. obviously we've had a lot of this discussion on the Senate floor as well as in the Finance Committee, that what our budgeting has not recognized over the last X number of years is what inflation does. And this is a very good illustration, separate from some of our, I'll suggest, somewhat esoteric discussions on the Senate floor and in the Finance Committee on inflation. This is a very good and direct example of how inflation and the lack thereof within a budget creates significant problems. The bill is very simple. It asks that $57 million be appropriated to reflect the inflation cost of the system, including such areas as health, health insurance, utilities, and staff salaries. Now, obviously, the Minsky system, and this is obviously also true of any of the U of M system as well, but Minsky and its individual campuses cannot absorb heating costs. The decision to be made by Minsky otherwise would be we're not going to heat the classrooms. I suppose that decision could be made. It would probably be an unwise decision, both in terms of the maintenance of the student body and those people staying in the Minsky colleges and universities. We could ignore health insurance costs. Obviously, that would be rolling back the clock X number of decades to have to not have that kind of coverage. Or we could say we are not going to provide any type of inflationary cost of living increase to faculty and staff salaries. The consequence of that, obviously, if that continues over the years, is that some of the first-rate instructors in particular will easily find another school to go to. Maybe it'll be in the Wisconsin system. Maybe it'll be in one of the Dakota systems. Maybe it'll be in the California system. The competence of the faculty we have in both the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota system is something that's been a great source of pride, not just simply to the student bodies within those campuses, but to the state of Minnesota. We've had a very excellent higher ed system. If you're not going to provide the ongoing budgetary maintenance for a higher education system, you will get that second-rate higher education system in the near future. All we have to do to look for a very significant example is to go to the west, the state of Colorado. Now, they had other problems with their budget, but they walled off their budget with some huge statutory dedications. But they have now set up a higher ed system that basically is a private system. There's a very, I don't know if I'd suggest insignificant, but a very poor public higher education system because they were not providing the dollars needed to the higher education system. So this bill makes the case that if we're not going to provide an inflationary increase to the Minsky budget, we start eroding that quality system. Now, the individuals from the Minsky system, whether the campuses or from the central administration, can talk in more detail about why we need to cover inflation. But this, I think, makes the point that I was trying to make on the Senate floor in a much more direct and possibly cogent way. So that's the legislation, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. King, could you tell us how is the inflation calculation determined?
Certainly, Madam Chair. I'd be delighted to. Let me, if I might, though, introduce who is with me here at the table today. To my left is John Quisgard, the president of Bemidji State University. And to his left is Cheryl Frank, the president of Inverhills Community College.
Welcome.
They're here representing the presidents as the officers of our leadership group, council group, which is our governing group of presidents and chancellor staff. And we're delighted to have them here with us today. And I know they'd be delighted to answer any questions you might have about how these big numbers translate into campus impacts. Mm-hmm. The calculation for inflation was done following guidelines from the Department of Finance. So we used the 3.25% guidance that they provided. That's applied both to compensation and to other operating costs. As Senator Cohen mentioned, about 30% of our budget is for non-personnel-related expenses. We have to heat and cool and clean and light about 26 million square feet, for one thing. That's a substantial portion of that number. In addition, we have supply costs and equipment costs and et cetera. So that's about 30%, and we added inflation to that as well. At 3.25%. That results in a biennial inflation burden of $130 million. What you have here in front of you today is a request for just $57 million with the expectation that we would use a 4% tuition increase to provide the balance. It has been our practice for going back pre-merger to come to the legislature in partnership with our students, asking the legislature to contribute part of the cost of inflation and the students through a tuition increase to contribute the other part. It has its genesis, I think, in the language and statute about the public-private sharing of the cost of higher education, the one-third private and the two-thirds public. And we translate that into sharing the inflation costs between appropriation and tuition. I think it's also worth noting, and to Senator Cohen's earlier remarks, I looked back over the last 10 years and to look and see how has the inflation issue been handled in the budget process, and found, and in all those 10 years, we had this tuition state appropriation partnership in the approach, and found that about 40% of our request to the legislature for inflation funding was received. So we have absorbed 60% of our inflation costs over the last 10 years, either through reallocation or extraordinary tuition increases. So we're here this year, we hope, with your support, enabling us to provide a reasonable compensation adjustment, cover our utility costs, which have gone up 17% in the last 3 years alone, and keep the burden on tuition down to the board's target of 4%.
President, did you want to add anything about the importance of inflation?
Chair Pappas and members of the committee, on behalf of all of our Minnesota State Colleges and University presidents, we are, in all of us, in support of this request. We need it very much to help our students learn and complete their goals. So we just really urge your support as this moves forward.
Senator Pappas and committee members, I'd like to echo the comments made by the President. These are interesting times in higher education. Much is changing in terms of the way we deliver higher education, and with that, we need to provide different types of learning environments to accommodate new technologies, to accommodate new approaches to learning. And I think one of the most exciting is to become far more interactive so that we're not building spaces any longer that have laboratories here and lecture halls here. They're new learning environments that we know lead to a lot better outcomes, so I encourage you to support this. Thank you.
Ms. King, when's the last time that Minsky received inflation from the legislature?
In the fiscal 2002-2003 biennium, we had a request at that time of $98 million, and we received $80
million. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, Ms. King, $73 million is the number that you need in order to not raise tuition. Is that correct? An extra $73
Madam
million?
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, on the inflation request, $57 million is the number we need in order to not raise tuition more than the 4% we've already committed to.
You need another $73 million to not raise
We would need another $73 million to raise tuition zero.
And what would the number be to get us back to the 67%, 33% split student and institution?
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, it depends on how you approach it. If you hold state appropriations steady and buy down tuition, you get one number. If you hold tuition steady and buy up state appropriation, you get another number. It ranges in the $200 to $600 million range, depending upon how you come at it.
Give me the $200 million range.
Yeah. Give me a second to dig out a piece of paper, and I'll get that for you.
All right.
Mr. Albrecht did a similar calculation. Do you want to tell us what you came up with?
Actually, I just used the information that was provided by both the University of Minnesota and Minsky, and together it would cost about $565 million before anything happens this session.
To go back to the two-third, one-third?
Correct.
Right. We were about 7 years ago we were there.
Yeah.
That's so long ago.
Madam Chair, that would translate into lowering tuition and replacing it with state appropriation? Is that the model that Mr. Albrecht calculated?
I asked him to just answer Senator Tomasoni's question, is what would it take to bring us to the two-thirds state contribution, then assuming one-third student, where we were 7 years ago?
Right, and you get there by reducing the tuition rate. Otherwise, the consequence is that you're giving us net more money to spend, and tuition's not changing.
I see.
So just to be clear, if you want us to finish out with a dollar and you change the mix inside the dollar, or you give us more money to spend and change the mix as a result.
It seems to me this is doable, you know, over a period of years, but wouldn't it be more reasonable to hold tuition flat and increase state appropriations?
Madam Chair, what you'll see
in three bienniums.
What you'll see in our budget request is that with your support of our full request and with tuition increasing the 4% that our board's committed to, we would move that 50% state support to 53%. So we would start that recovery, but we would do it in addition with a tuition increase. So you have to move both parts, which is what we're suggesting. If you were to move just the state appropriation part with no tuition change, then you wouldn't move that far.
I don't. That doesn't make sense, because it seems to me if you held tuition flat and you gave more state appropriations, you'd get to the 2/3, 1/3 sooner than if you raised tuition. You'd have to provide more state.
That's right.
Appropriations.
That's right. That's the only.
Right.
That's right.
All right. Great. Any other questions on this bill, Senator St. John?
Madam Chair, and maybe initially to Senator Cohen, since he's been involved in state government finance for far longer than I've been around here, but I have not, I don't believe, seen an appropriation, or seen an inflation bill in any other aspect of at least state government when I've sat in on a finance committee. Is this unique to higher education? And Madam Chair, did I hear you mention this, that we had an inflation bill 2 or 3 years ago? I guess the question basically is, do we typically have bills? Because I've never seen one in, you know, county committees, environment, transportation, or I don't believe I've ever seen an inflation bill. Is this unique?
Ms. King, or Senator Cohen.
Well, Madam Chair, Chancellor King wanted to respond initially. So.
Chancellor King.
Oh, go ahead.
No.
Madam Chair and Senator St. John, it is unique in this regard. You will see in the governor's budget recommendations, in all of the executive branch agencies, there is a base budget adjustment to pay for inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's above the line, so to speak, and doesn't pop out as an initiative like this does. That's one difference. It's a little harder to see. Another difference is that until the law was changed in 2002, inflation was recognized in the higher ed accounts, like it is in K-12 accounts and human service accounts. And then once the law changed, it was no longer recognized, and we had to bring it in as an initiative.
Senator Cohen.
And Chair, Ms. King took my answer, but I'll supplement what she said, because when she was Commissioner of Finance with Governor Carlson, that's exactly, Senator St. John, how the budget's read. And so you'd look at the budget pages, and you'd see, you could determine within an agency, within a higher ed system, whatever it is, you could determine the inflationary figure. And what we did historically in budgeting around this place is, you know, we'd look at whatever that inflation figure was, and Ms. King, I don't know if it was, I can't recall the dollar amounts in terms of the total of state government.
It was smaller than it is
today. You know, say back in
the
600, the
90s. 700, yeah.
But you take a look at that figure and you'd say, okay, we're going to apportion so much of this inflation factor. The rest we might rework throughout the budgets. But you'd be able to pick out within the budgets. So, you know, the direct answer to your question is no, we haven't done this before, but we haven't budgeted in this fashion before. And it predates Ms. King was Commissioner King.
Mm-hmm.
It was true with Commissioner Gagneau. It was true with Commissioner Kodrowski. And I don't recall in my earlier days, I wasn't paying quite as much attention with maybe Tom Triplett as commissioner. But you'd see it reflected different in our budget pages.
Madam Chair.
Senator St. John.
Looking at this then, $57 million, as I recall, the Minsky total request this year is 177. So would the 57 then fit within, if you will, the 177?
That's right, okay. Madam Chair, Senator Senjum. It's part of our 177 request.
Okay.
And Senator Cohen, is this inflation adjustment part of the governor's recommendation?
Well, Madam Chair, to the extent that budget dollars are fungible, you can make the argument that the governor has funded inflation but has not done much else with higher education, so that maybe we fund the inflation part of the budget, but we do nothing else with higher ed. We don't recognize other salary kinds of concerns, tuition concerns. But certainly the governor's budget does not reflect inflation as former Commissioner King has just described.
And we're actually going to hear about the governor's Minsky recommendation a little bit later this afternoon, so we'll wait for that. Any other questions, Senator Senjum?
Madam Chair, and again, maybe perhaps to Ms. King, I think I know the answer I'm going to be asking. Does this take some flexibility? I mean, it looks like by passage of this bill, no matter what, we'll spend $57 million for inflation, just kind of count it. Whereas if we didn't have this bill and simply appropriated 177, left you the flexibility, you know, to work within that number, you're going to pay for inflation anyway. I understand that. But does this take any flexibility away from your budgeting process?
Ms. King.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, I know that the chair imagines pulling all these into one bill, and so it will matter what the bill looks like, absolutely. If this is a separate bill, and it directs this to be spent on inflation, then yes, to the extent that we would want to spend it anywhere else, which we wouldn't, it would take that flexibility away. But if there's a block grant appropriation, mm-hmm. Which with language that says the appropriation includes funds for inflation, technology, centers of excellence, it does give our board some discretion to manage within the target.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if we look in the budget book, you know, we can see they're, I mean, they've broken down their requests just because they think that's what we like, rather than just they tell us how they're going to spend the money, in other words. But we don't, you know, sure. hold them to every single dollar.
Okay.
It's in a rider language. Okay, then the motion is by Senator Cohen to move that Senate File 581 be laid over for consideration of inclusion in the omnibus bill.
That's what I'm moving. Yes.
Do we vote on it? Emily?
Is she on this?
We don't vote on it. Sure. Yes. All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Oh, it's kind of fun to vote.
Probably don't even have to.
Vote too much. All right, we'll vote.
The natural one.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. The three of you can stay, and then we'll just switch senators and Senator Senjum. And I understand, Senator Senjum, we have an amendment. Senator Senjum, you want to just talk a little bit about the bill and then the amendment while it's being passed out?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here today to talk in reference to a bonding bill for HEPER, for Minnesota State College University System. I've had, I think, the great pleasure over the course of my 4 years in the Senate to travel nearly, I believe, to every Minsky campus, or if not all, very, very close to all of them with Senator Langsett. And during the course of doing that, of course, you observe many things and many good things, but you also observe that we have a system that physically is either wearing out or is in constant need of upgrades, of a replacement, of improvements. And so, Madam Chair and members, this is frankly what this is all about. If you're not aware, I know that Senator Langsett wants to place a special emphasis this year within the bonding bill on on what we call HEPER, replacement improvements and so on and so forth. And so this particular bill allocates $30 million to do that. As a matter of history, last year's bonding bill, I think the request was $110 million. 40 was allocated for HEPER. So we continue to try to work to catch up. We may never get there, but I think it's our duty to keep moving down that road and pursuing the improvements that need to be made in our system if we're going to keep it in the fashion and the state that we want it to be. Madam Chair and members, I think with that, I have an amendment, CA1 amendment, but is it passed out?
Yes, it is. Let me just ask, though, to Vice Chancellor King, Senior Vice Chancellor, Vice Chancellor King, or Senator Senjum, if you have the HEPER list, so members can see where all the repairs are going to be around the state.
Madam Chair, it was in your packet last week. I apologize. I don't have more copies. I can tell you while you're looking that of the $30 million, we would envision $9.7 million for roofs, $7.6 million for heating and cooling systems, $2 million for fire protection, and $10 million for tuck pointing and exterior repair and asbestos removal.
I do see it in this book in summary, as you stated, but we actually think it's important to have the breakdown so that members of the legislature can see where that money's going and in whose district and all the important projects.
We'll get that for you. I thought it was in your possession already, so we'll see that you have that before the day's out.
You don't even care.
Okay, then Senator Senjum, the A1 amendment, why don't we just put it on, then you can explain
sure.
it. Senator Senjum moves the A1 amendment be added to Senate File 552. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Senjum.
And, Madam Chair, the A1 amendment simply adds $3.8 million to this request for basically lands for Bemidji State University and the Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, again, for land either adjacent to those respective institutions or as part of their master planning. And if you have any questions specific to the amendment, Madam Chair, I know we have our good friend from Bemidji State. I don't know if anybody from Fond du Lac is here, but perhaps you can speak to that.
President, I think that's a good idea.
Madam Chair, the request for Bemidji State involves the acquisition of a high school property that's been sitting vacant for a considerable period of time. If you've been to Bemidji, or even if you haven't been to Bemidji, the campus itself is landlocked. We have a lake along one side, a public park, and we have no room for growth or expansion. And we have a substantial problem with something called parking. And so this would help us to begin to alleviate that situation and do some shifting around of some practice fields and some playing fields.
The Fond du Lac?
The Fond du Lac property is related to the campus expansion that you've helped fund for us in the last several rounds. It's residential property to the south of the campus that we are we had before you last year for acquisition as part of our improvement program at that campus, and it was not funded last year. It's really a high priority for us because of the disruption change that we're presenting to the residential property owners on the south boundary of the campus. So we're very hopeful that you can support it this year.
And these were in the Senate bonding bill last year, I believe?
They were in our request and in your position, but they didn't come out of conference.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I would just say, having served on the bonding committee the last 4 years, these two requests, and being on the conference committee last year, these two requests were before us, but it was my understanding at that time that the House was opposed to these two requests, and so they were not moved forward. And so I would just say that these are really important requests, and I'm hoping that we can move forward with them. So
I don't recall if the House was opposed, or
well,
the conferees didn't want to put
this in the conference committee report. So I don't know if they were opposed, but it didn't get in the final version.
Right.
But it wasn't. I don't know if they didn't feel it was a high enough priority. But I know that Senator Langseth wanted to put these in there. If I'm not mistaken, he did want these in there. And but it was being that the House did not want them, so then we did not in turn have those in there. So they have been requesting these for quite some time.
Sure. So the staff did find the capital budget request so that members can look and see around the state what the – and this is not in priority list, I understand.
That's correct, Madam Chair. It's not in priority order.
So if we don't get the full $30 million, we don't exactly know what will drop off. So all these projects are at risk. Or do you have a priority list?
No, ma'am, we do not.
Okay. So as we look around the state, Senator Clark, St. Cloud Technical College, Minneapolis, Itasca, does anyone have Itasca Community College? It's not in your area, is it, Senator Coring?
No, but there is several on here, Madam Chair. Central Lakes College, replacement of fire alarm system, Central Lakes College.
Century College, Senator Wieger.
But, Madam Chair?
Yes?
If we fund the entire $30 million, all of these projects will get funded.
That's right. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the bottom line.
Quite a few Rochester projects here for Senator Lynch.
Thank you very much. Duly noted.
Looks like
a little bit too much. Elevator. St. Paul College replaced the elevator. I think, didn't we get stuck in that elevator once when we were over there? I don't think so. It's expensive. And a St. Cloud State, too. Great. Okay, Senator Latz. Anything for you, Senator Latz, on the list?
No, Madam Chair. I don't have any Minsky institutions in my district, so I'm a free agent.
Me too.
All right.
Madam Chair, if I might, Senator Senjum, in your conversations with Senator Langseth, has he indicated that he's receptive to this particular dollar amount, or has the request been tailored toward that, since this still wouldn't bring Minsky up to the $110 million they asked for in last year's HEPA request?
Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, I cannot speak for Senator Langseth. I don't think anyone can or dares do that. But I know that his priority is HEPA this year, and I think he's going to give it the strongest possible play in terms of the bonding bill. But specific to a number, you never really know that until literally the last hour, the last minute, perhaps.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Senja, maybe I should ask a follow-up to you and to the Minsky representatives. Why not ask for the balance of the 110 that was not given last year? Why not ask for the full 70 instead of asking for 33.8 now?
Madam Chair, I cannot speak to that. I don't know if the Minsky representatives can.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, we had a long conversation about that internally as we were approaching the session. It was our direction from the executive branch that this was a non-bonding year, and that the governor wasn't interested in bonding proposals. And so that was in our ears as we were thinking about it. And we also didn't have any indication that there was going to be a large bonding bill coming from either the House or the Senate. So in that environment, we tailored our request toward a non-bonding year proposal. As I have said, I think in this body before, HEPA has been our number one priority for 10 years, and we are very committed to making as much of an impact as we can. So there's nothing magic about the $30 million. It was fashioned to get to the highest emergencies we have, the most critical projects. And respond to the general request for emergency year bonding proposals.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Vice Chancellor King. So the $30 million that you're asking for were deemed to be critical Obviously, you had to draw the line somewhere, and you're like $600 million behind on your HEPA requests, and your requests have been rebuffed by the legislature over the years in favor of more specific building requests for obvious political reasons, but not respecting Minsky's prioritization process. I don't know what the bonding bill is going to look like, but given how far behind Minsky is in your HEPA process, would it be fair to say that you could easily respond to a $70 million HEPA bonding allocation to meet emergency critical needs for the system?
Ms. King.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, we have experience pushing that much money through the system, if that's your question. Could we program and commit and expend that amount of money between now and next year? No. But could we get it in commitments between now and next year? Yes, we could.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Vice Chancellor King, would you be able to characterize a full $70 million request as meeting emergency or critical needs for the system?
Ms. King.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, I would want to look a little bit before I answer that question. I think we have critical needs. Emergency, I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at the work papers to see what the emergencies add up to.
Okay.
And
Senator
I'd be
Roebling.
Happy to do that.
Senator Roebling, then we're going to move on.
Thank you. This is to that issue. I think that the reason we can't go higher is because we have kind of a bonding limit, and I think it's only about $130 million this year, and we self-impose that because we don't want to have any higher than a certain percent of our state budget going to pay off bond debt. But we also do that or choose to do that because we want to keep our AAA bond rating, which gives us lower interest rates. So if we did do a $70 million request just for Minsky this year, it would eat up, you know, better than half of our whole bonding authority. And if we had no other emergency bonding requests, that would probably be appropriate. But I think that they're trying to accommodate other concerns and issues that will be coming forward and that they want to keep under the $130 million.
Okay, thank you. Senator Senjum, the motion is to send the bill to finance.
And Madam Chair, I would respectfully urge support for this. It's $33.8 million. It's important. We need to move this forward. And again, request respectfully the member's support.
So Senator Senjum moves that Senate File 552 is amended, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Now, we're going to have a short presentation on the Management Innovation Initiative with Vice Chancellor Mimi. No? We have no bill, right. We have no bill. We just want to hear about it.
We're asking for $10 million.
Okay.
Something we're calling Management Innovation.
I'm saying Rochester's doing it.
We're stealing
again. Where's Rochester's doing?
Move to reform.
You turn the mic toward you?
Certainly. Otherwise, clear the path for innovation. And we use that word to describe everything from what programs do we deliver to how do we deliver the programs to where do we deliver the programs, what resources do we use, how do we deploy staff, all the things that go into our serving students, our candidates in our minds for identifying innovations that we could bring to our business. And what we're asking for in this request is funds that would be available to us to help make some of those changes happen. It might translate into adding class sections, identifying equipment that would be helpful, paying for release time so that faculty could do new course development work, adding modules to our student services programs so that students could benefit from some of the additional services that we'd like to make available to them. We imagine this to be, in some respects, kind of an R&D pot for the delivery and service to students. It's a new idea for us. It's a new idea for us to bring to you, but we're so committed to making the changes we need to make to respond to the students of today and tomorrow. We're certain that if we had some resources available, that we could really make some changes happen more quickly, more creatively, and to faster benefit for the students. We're calling it Management Innovations. It is not identified with any particular kind of expense, but is imagined more generally as being available to help presidents as they identify hurdles in different kinds of expenses. So we haven't put that kind of a string on it. Maybe if I can turn to Vice Chancellor Baer, she's got a couple of examples more specifically that might help explain.
Thank you, Vice President. Vice Chancellor Baer.
Chair Pappas, this is a time where innovation may be one of the key characteristics of meeting people's needs with some of the existing things we're doing, but improving upon some of those things, as well as people doing new things to better add value to education. And so we have doing what we're already doing better and also doing new things. Some of our examples we have been piloting in reference to meeting students' needs better, improving upon some of the student services that we're able to do, either through people-to-people, more opportunities where our faculty and staff, counselors are advising students, and also adding some of the technology that allows us 24/7 opportunities to answer questions, advise, or have help desks. Those would be some examples.
Did you have a similar initiative 2 years ago?
Chair Pappas, no, we didn't have a similar one.
All right. And Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, either Ms. King or Baer, does this have kind of like a Q? Is this kind of like a Q comp component in there, or performance pay in this bill too, or in this proposal? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Chair Pappas and Senator Coring, this has what it would take to continue to improve upon our student learner outcomes. This has what it would take to continue to be more adaptable and responsive to our student needs in the classroom or outside the classroom.
And Madam Chair, I believe this is the bill that was sent over to my office, and I have didn't get it put in yet, so I will be getting it introduced then.
That's fine.
Okay. All right.
And, I think I'm still not really understanding what you're going to do with this. Yes.
Chair Pappas, maybe I can provide a little bit of insight, hopefully. At Bemidji State University, we're pioneering the use of some 3D holographic technology. This is kind of Star Wars stuff that sits there and comes at you in all kinds of different three-dimensional formats. And we need to further develop that. The preliminary studies show that the use of this technology increases the retention or increases long-term memory by 200%. So think what that could mean if we could more fully develop that, add in additional content areas beyond where it's been introduced right now. And so these types of funds would go for initiatives of that type that will better meet the learners' needs in the 21st century and the diversity of the ways that they do learn in the 21st century. So that would be an example of a pioneering technology and how it applies to learning.
You're not researching it. You're really applying new technology to help the student learner.
Chair Pappas, yes, that's correct.
Madam Chair, to convert this into our earlier discussion about budget initiatives, we could imagine using these resources to buy release time. to buy additional equipment, to pay the costs of converting from one kind of instructional delivery to another. So it's to pay costs that are incremental costs to making the change. Whether it's a 3D initiative at Bemidji, or it's a learning module in Lake Superior that they want to translate into Spanish. Maybe there's an innovation that's coming their way.
Campuses submit kind of requests for submit proposals to plug into this pot of money?
Madam Chair, we could absolutely do it that way.
I mean, I don't know how you do it.
That's one possibility. Another possibility is that it just becomes part of their basic allocation, and we ask them to tell us how they used it. So we skip the RFP process and just...
You expect everyone to...
We expect everyone to innovate, and here are the resources available to you, and know that we're going to want to know how you used it.
Hmm.
And Madam Chair, I got a question, too.
Senator Coyne.
And Madam Chair and Vice Chancellor King, when you say by release time, can you expand on it a little more? What do you mean by release time? I think I know what you mean.
Chair Pappas and Senator Coring,
in
the context of where there's workload and certain amounts of expected duty time, when we buy release time, or it's more likely reassigned time, it's allowing faculty then to work in a different place than possibly the direct education, the direct classroom work. So they may have time, X number of credits out to do curriculum development, or the 3D operation may take particular time to develop the curriculum and also train in the use of it, the equipment, and so on.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Quisgard, does this Star Wars technology help you remember things you already forgot?
Get the right answer.
I have a Senator Tomasoni. I've actually volunteered to be a guinea pig. And what they're finding is that I've reached that point in life where I'm not educable or trainable anymore.
That's what worried me. Okay.
I'm kind of looking at the budget book on page 19 under Minsky, where it says key measures. And I'm assuming this is key measures of... Is that the key measures of the whole section, or just key measures of the Management Innovation Initiative? It says page 819 of your change item section. It's under Minsky for members. It says one key measure will be the competitiveness of our total compensation for each employee group relative to the appropriate peer group. Success would be to ensure that the system has the ability to provide total compensation to the most innovative and productive of employees above the 70th percentile of the appropriate peer group. It sounds like performance pay. That sounds like. So it doesn't sound at all like what you were talking about.
Well, Chair Pappas, what we're looking for is the opportunity to have resources that can, in fact, enhance innovative opportunities. And so our faculty do wonderful things. They work very hard, but times are changing very dramatically, and what we're looking for are some of those opportunities to allow them to learn about more of these opportunities, develop some of those new opportunities. And so with the terminology of release time or something that would allow
that's what you mean
additional
by release time.
Yes. They would be able to take time to learn more about this. We have sabbatical opportunities or professional development opportunities, but this is more ready reference to as we go, not waiting for a time when there might have been a sabbatical opportunity.
And where are you?
Chair Pappas, my name is Bill Cheetah. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources and the one responsible for that particular measure, which might not be worded as well as it is. But the fact of the matter is... the compensation, there is additional compensation when you have to provide overload for curriculum development, new projects, and that sort of thing. I think one of the examples is the Min Online and the compensation, the way faculty were compensated for Min Online, which generally was additional compensation for them, and that's what we're looking at there.
Okay. Great. Okay, thank you. Then we need to move on to Senator Clark's bill, Senate File 567, Enterprise Information Technology Investment Strategic Plan Implementation. And I think if you want to look at the budget book, what page is that on? is page what?
20.
Page 20. The Minsky section, change item, page 20, technology infrastructure. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Kind of a fun day because I started off my day talking about the importance of investment in early childhood education, in part to help prepare us to have students at the right space. And now we get to talk a little bit about another tool that's really important if we want to be competitive, which is technology. And I think all of us know how quickly technology is changing, how important it is to our future. And each of us may have some idea about how challenging it is for the system to keep up with the changes. A couple numbers just to throw out. Just on online education, course-based online education through MinSCU has grown in 2003 from 16,300 students to 40,700 students in 2006. That's a rapid change. We're also seeing a lot more demand for doing registration online. There's been crashes due to when a lot of students are on at the same time. There are some fraying at the seams. We're getting to the point where we could be a bit obsolete because the reality is with these kinds of changes, we need to keep current. The request in front of you for the biennium is $30 million in 2008 and $40 million in 2009. And there's four key areas, if you'll put up with me quickly, and then we'll turn it over to the people with the details. First is providing easy and reliable access to all MinSCU all the colleges and universities in the MinSCU system, information and technology systems and tools, including real-time availability so students, faculty, and staff can focus on learning, teaching, and efficient business processes. Two, significantly enhanced security and identity management to protect against security breaches. Three, renovate current administrative systems, including things like student records, finance, and human resources, to support technological changes with software vendors. And four, making it easier for students, faculty, and staff to quickly and simply access the systems and data they need through the portal technology. All of these really are critical if we're going to end up making sure we've got seamless systems, and if we really want to make sure we're making the best use of the investment, I think, overall. So it fits certainly with the inflation issues that Senator Cohen brought up and our capital issues like leaky roofs and boilers, among other things. But this is also a critical investment we need to be making in our future.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Pappas, members of the committee, add a few items to that.
Just say your name for the team.
I'm sorry. I'm Ken Nemi, Vice Chancellor for IT and CIO for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. To add a few items to that very succinct overview of what the technology request is for. As we were talking about the HEPA requests and the idea of deferred maintenance, I think the bulk of this request fits in that same area. We've deferred maintenance on our technology infrastructure for quite a number of years now. Our current systems are approaching 15 years of age from a design standpoint. We're being designed before the system was built. They're also built on a core infrastructure component that's no longer manufactured. It's kind of like if you had a house and you had a furnace built by a company that's no longer in business and you can't buy repair parts for it anymore. It gets a little bit nervous when the temperature dips below zero, and we've been at that point. Starting a couple of years ago, we really were reaching a point where the rivets were popping out of what we had. Peak loads at key registration times, more services being put online, and online learning. All three of those things were starting to drive us to recognize that we had to do something, and we had to do something fast. In the last year and a half, we've put some short-term patches in place that get us through, but barely get us through those travails as we move forward. But it's clear that we have to make a key redesign and a retooling of our entire technology infrastructure, something that we have never done in the history of the MinSCU system. A few questions relating to this overall technology request, some relating to how we went through the process of coming up with the estimates of these costs. First step in creating those estimates was a putting together of a plan that we called our IT Strategic Investment Plan. This was done at the direction of Chancellor McCormick at that time when the rivets were popping out of the boiler about 2 years ago. We brought in an outside expert who was able to interview significant numbers of people, 250 campus administrators at various forums, to really hone in on what our IT structure was, where the problems were, and formulate a plan for investment to resolve those issues. Upon completion of that plan and acceptance of that plan by the Leadership Council, all the presidents and all the vice chancellors and direct reports to the chancellor, we then went ahead within our IT operation and started clarifying the scope of those efforts, of the various initiatives and projects that made up those efforts. As we went through that, those projects clarified what would be delivered as part of that, we began the next step, which was to analyze and begin estimation of the individual cost components of each initiative based on Minsky past history within various projects we had done in the past and some national comparisons for similar projects and subcomponents. Personnel costs were determined by looking at the key qualifications needed for specific required functions. For example, if we needed an Oracle database administrator, it's clear that we do, and we need backup in those areas as well, we determined that, looked at the average current pay then for that skill level that was required in order to build up those estimates. In the area of hardware, and hardware is a significant portion of this request, we reviewed our hardware capacity requirements for the project, including estimated peak loads, what our current situation was when things were failing during peak loads, then basing our estimate based on current state contract prices or what our history had been of purchases internally or leases, if that was appropriate. In the area of software, another key cost component, we identified candidate system software applications for the project and would base the estimate on current state contract prices. These are pieces of software that do things such as database management, assist us in operations of data center to find problems before they occur, and in security software. Those are three key areas of that. In facilities, we estimated rental space and per-foot cost needed to house the size of the project team that we estimated in earlier steps in this, both staff and contractor, in order to make those software changes in our core systems that we needed. Finally, in the area of services, we identified where we would need to use outside contractors to assist us. By the way, the criteria we generally use for that are looking for where skill sets are not available in-house in our own employees, and in short supply in the job market, where tasks to be performed are one time only. That is, it's a 9-month, 12-month, 6-month task where you wouldn't want to hire somebody and then lay them off as soon as the project was done. Makes sense to bring in contractors. And finally, where the tasks are very specialized and the vendor has specific qualifications in the area. That would be in an area like converting from one database to another, where we've never done that. Nobody in the state has done that, but contractors make a living nationally by doing that. We build up those estimates then from the hours required and hourly costs based on our past experience again and existing state contracts. Another step that we use in many of these things is really ongoing right now, and that's our estimates, as we keep on honing them to a greater level of detail, are being verified by pilot projects and adjusted as necessary. I'll give you an example of that. We have undertaken a small pilot project to convert some of our human resources programs and our administrative systems and convert those from RDB, the old database, to Oracle, the new database. We've contracted for that assistance working with our staff, and we're able to confirm based on that size, are early estimates correct or do they need to be adjusted? And early indications are that we're fairly close to where those were. So we have opportunities to hone those as those estimates go forward over that period of time. In the area of services, I identify the outside contractors in the pilot projects. Training and supplies, we have to determine what training materials may be needed. And again, by past experience and best practices nationwide, we identify those, look at the number of people that would need to be trained, and come up with those costs. Finally, in the area of campus grants, we're proposing a minimum of $5 million per year is proposed to upgrade campus technology infrastructure and support, and that's based on various institutional technology plans, security reviews that we've performed, and the reports of campus CIOs. last step is we perform a reality check on these estimates by comparisons and discussions with some of our national peers who have gone through a replatforming process like this, be they in California or Nevada or Wisconsin or the University of Minnesota. We have also had discussions with outside advisory services such as Gartner to verify the accuracy of our general estimates in moving forward. And then we confirm some of those key assumptions and estimates with actual pilot projects. We've just completed a data center consolidation about a year ago that gave us a good estimate of what it takes to move data centers around into just that hardware infrastructure. So that helps confirm those. Finally, we have extensive discussions among our five senior ITS managers to verify that it fits in with our history in higher ed and in state government and in the private sector. And among those five managers, we have well over 100 years of overall IT experience and history. Actually, it's well over 125 years, I think. So that is our final step in these kind of approaches in verifying our estimates and building our project plans for moving forward. Madam Chair and members, there were some other questions relating to, if I can find my piece of paper here, the distribution of some of the work. Both centrally and for campuses. And the paper isn't jumping out at me. I'll take a breath here for a second until I find that. There we go. The first question was, how many new positions would we be looking at creating in this technology request? And our plans were, again, looking at the needs for ongoing maintenance as well as new development, that 70 new positions would have been created by the end of the biennium in our plan. Second, it was focused in the area of how many of these positions would be employed by individual institutions and how many by the central office. And in this particular initiative, the focus is on enterprise IT services. All 70 of those positions would be created in the campus services side of the Office of the Chancellor staff, providing services in direct support for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We'd expect, though, that approximately half of those positions would be housed at our existing ITS staff locations that are spread around the state. About half the people are in St. Paul. The other half are located in St. Cloud, Moorhead, Mankato, Granite Falls, and Bemidji. So our expectation is that we would hire as our current distribution is. So that would be split about half-half. Another area is how much of the total technology request will be to provide direct instructional versus administrative system support. And because the bulk of our deferred maintenance is in the administrative system side, HR, student registration, IT, the bulk of the money will be spent in that area. However, direct support for instruction will be over $4.5 million of the requested funding for the biennium. So a significant share, even though it's less than 10%, would be focused directly on support for the learning environment. However, much of that remaining spending on administrative system does have an impact on student learning support and a direct impact on the academic process. Things like improved student class registration, improved prerequisite checking for our enrollment in classes, enhanced electronic library services, improved e-learning system performance and availability are things that have an indirect impact, certainly, on the academic environment. Finally, as we catch up on that large backlog of deferred maintenance on administrative systems, that would allow us to free up more resources that can be then more directed to the academic support efforts over time. Finally, how much is spent through the system office, how much spent on campuses? 57.5% of the $70 million request is intended to be spent on an enterprise basis for all the benefit of all institutions, but spent centrally. $12.5 million is earmarked for distribution to colleges and universities for local technology infrastructure improvements and innovative pilot projects in the application of technology to support the learning environment. Madam Chair, that's hopefully that was quick enough. Probably wasn't.
Well, that was very thorough. So the governor recommends $60 million, $30 million in ongoing and for over the biennium and $30 million in one time. What does that mean for what we can do?
Madam Chair, members, we've thought very carefully about what that means. I have to say that from past experience, one of the worst things, one of the most difficult things to deal with from an IT perspective is one-time money. you can buy a machine, you can't afford to operate it. On the other hand, we do have that significant backlog of deferred maintenance in the IT area, so that first $45 million that first year is very positive development and help us eliminate that relatively quickly. We do believe that the full $70 million and more than $15 million per year in ongoing maintenance is going to be required, and we've discussed this with our Leadership Council Technology Committee, and the presidents are feel strongly that we need to do better than that $15 million if we're to maintain those gains that we make out of the spending of the initial. But we're very pleased that the governor has recommended the importance of this need and has offered to fund it at a significant level.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much, Senator Clark. Let's move on to, this time is passing us by, to Senator Wieger, Senate Law 553.
We need to do a motion.
Oh, yes, we want a motion. Sorry.
I'd like to move to go ahead and lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you. Sorry. Senator Wieger, we're looking at page 17 in the budget book.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, division members. Senate File 553 provides hope. Hope for thousands of Minnesota students, perhaps 6,000 plus that we want to target in high school right now, plus thousands that will be attending the MinSCU system. First, we want to recruit more, particularly those that are underrepresented in the system right now. People of color, people that are from low-income families, or perhaps neither parent went to college. The bill appropriates $24 million. The formula would have a fair amount go to each of the MinSCU campus representatives and based on population. There's also funds, $8 million, I believe, that would go for pilot programs for innovative proposals. Additionally, the system would match this with $10 million. The deliverables I mentioned, they're on the budget page. 6,700 more underrepresented students attending in fall of 2008, including 1,500 more students of color, and 17,000 underrepresented students, including 5,500 students of color receiving academic support services through new or expanded retention initiatives. There's also further explanation in the MinSCU budget booklet at page 4. You have the budget page, and I have several resource persons available and would stand for questions.
Oh, okay. Who would like to speak?
Senator Pappas, we thank you for hearing this bill. We believe this is the bill of hope. This is very important in our campus, for our campus lives, for our students. What we've seen over the years as our budgets have been more crunched is probably less emphasis on some of our student services, basically. And we know that we've had a cost for that. We also know that more and more students are coming to us with more needs, and we are the open access institutions at our colleges. And so what we have here is a proposal that would begin to build back some of the very important student services and some of the best practices in serving those students. We know they're best practices because in the past years we've had some resources from the legislature that have assisted us in putting money out on the campuses, and we've been able to do tests tried and true what's made a difference at our colleges and universities to improve student recruitment and student retention and ultimately student graduation. There's a wealth of information about this. People know what makes a difference for students being retained. Summer bridge programs help, knowing more about what to expect. we know that even with eighth graders. If eighth graders meet with ninth grader faculty and teachers and peers, they do better in ninth grade. Well, this is about bridging from high school now to college, another critical bridge time. Our colleges and our universities often do freshman year experiences, but they haven't been able to meet all the students' needs that they'd like to. We know that learning communities work, where students, particularly at-risk students, come in cohorts. They become peers of one another. They care about one another, from first time coming to school as a traditional age to adult learners, and it works very nicely for adult learners coming in to become new teachers, for example, when they've got a peer group that helps them through. Intrusive advising is one of the other patterns that we are especially interested in. This is really keeping track of are our students making adequate progression or not, and making sure they know we care about them making adequate progression. And finally, some supplemental instruction, tutoring, the kinds of things that help. Many of these programs have been tested and tried out through a federal program called the TRIO program, which has been for those populations mentioned, the first-generation students, the low-income and more at-risk students. And so that's the basis of this request.
So how is what you're planning to do differ from the TRIO or the state has a program called ICAP?
Chair Pappas, very few of those students who qualify for TRIO program are served in TRIO programs first. Second, and President Frank can attest to this, not all of our campuses receive TRIO funding. You had a score of 98 out of 100 and did not receive the federal grant to provide TRIO programs at Denver Hills.
Mm. Only one was given to Minnesota, and so it's very, very competitive.
Yes.
And Chair Pappas, I might say that at Ember Hills Community College, we've grown to 44% first-generation college students. We've got something like 27 languages spoken. Our students of color have grown from 11% in 2000 to 17% now. And I want to thank you for some money that the legislature gave to MNSCU a couple of years ago that we did an RFP for that has really, we called it Ideas Plus, and it was working with our most at-risk students to help them be retained in college to go. It's really made a difference, and money like this would help us lift this up to the rest of the institution and make an impact on the very many growing numbers of students that this this would benefit by.
So, Vice Chancellor, was that what she's talking about, the President, is that from our 05 appropriation, serving the underserved?
Senator Pappas, yes, it's from past years over the last couple of years where we've had monies to serve underserved.
And you still have that? That's still kind of ongoing, targeted for that pot?
It's part of the $13.5 million of the last legislative session.
That was in your base. So what I'm saying is, are you continuing to use that, or once you fund a program in a campus, you continue to fund it, or does it move around? Or
Senator Pappas, at this point, it does not move around. It's initial seed money to begin to see what can be done. We did do 2 years, though. We had 2 years' worth of funding, and so we funded for the first year and required a report before funding for the second year in these projects. And then we also added an additional amount of money recently because of our board's especially important interest on serving the underserved. So we are funding, in essence, one time 2 years, as far as we know. And then what we hope to be able to do, and Dr. Lopez hosts our student affairs staff and members to best practices workshops where they can share what they've learned at these places where they've received the money. We never had enough money to actually grant everybody the resources they were asking for. And so what they can do then is find out what worked, how did it work, why did it work, and can you now transfer this to another campus?
So is this $24 million to supplement the 13.5 and be able to reach all campuses?
Correct.
Vice Chancellor Baer.
Senator Pappas, the 13.5 actually funded all of our initiatives of the last session. And so a part of it was this. We actually had a million for serving the underserved.
Excuse me. I see. Because we did the enrollment adjustment.
Correct.
Right. Okay, gotcha. I was wondering about that. Was a lot of money. Did you want to talk at all, Mr. Lopez?
Chair Pappas, about the only thing I'd like to say is that Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, as President Frank said, a lot of these programs that we funded are innovative programs. Some of them are similar to TRIO programs. President Quisgard has a program that was funded at his institution. They have a TRIO program, but they can't serve all of the students that would be eligible for those services, and so they developed a program that supplements their student support services program. The other thing that this funding does is it gives us a little bit of flexibility to go beyond the students that TRIO programs would serve. TRIO programs, because they're subject to federal regulations, have very strict eligibility guidelines. So, for example, low income is defined as someone from a family whose family income does not exceed 150% of the poverty guidelines. And so we go a little bit beyond that, still very low-income students, but we do have that flexibility to go beyond that.
Chair Pappas, I'm also reminded we do not have enrollment. We're not funded on the enrollment anymore. We're not funded based on enrollment.
Right. No, I was talking about last biennium.
Correct. Correct.
Right. I understand. Okay, any other questions from the committee? Let's see. All right. Senator Wigger, you want to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 553 be recommended
for
passage, but laid over for possible inclusion.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Over.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Right.
Thank you.
You, Senator Wigger. Senator Lynch, Senate File 537. Okay. Where is this? Is this the same? This is the same area, right? STEM?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am pleased to sit here today with Senate File 537. Senate File 537 provides for development in opportunities in the areas of science, technology, engineering, and math. I think one of the most exciting things about this particular component of the overall MNSCU budget is it certainly speaks to an increased dialogue between the K-12 system and the higher education institutions. And I think that's a real positive move. Specifically, this appropriation would increase student enrollment in those STEM courses, the science, technology, engineering, and math. And that serves to further promote those opportunities for students in potential career areas. Additionally, it also seeks to address the number of students who are going into the area of teaching as potential career opportunities, and specifically targets the increased opportunities for teachers in those core STEM areas. It's true in Minnesota as well as nationally that we have experienced over the last number of years consistent and significant declines in the number of math and science teachers that are coming out of our programs. I applaud the state universities collectively as they're working to respond to this dilemma, and I am told that there are plans that will, in fact, more than double the number of math and science teachers coming in out of our institutions significantly by the year 2011. Another provision that I think is important to note to the committee, I think it's always important that we have outcomes identified, and this will increase the percentage of students that are enrolled in at least one of those discipline areas. And again, it will increase significantly the number of students that are graduating from our institutions that can then go back into our high schools in those discipline areas. And with that, we're happy to stand for questions.
Any questions? Any other comments from the panel?
Senator Pappas, this is an area that I feel particularly passionate about. So much of the future of Minnesota and the future of this nation depends on having more people in science, more people in technology, engineering, and math. I think people around the room know that we're falling woefully behind the rest of the world in terms of the numbers of people that we're preparing in these critical areas. Simply put, we must find ways to have more individuals in the pipeline. We must work with K through 12. We must have more teachers coming out in these critical areas. If you were to have superintendents in here today, and you probably know this, they would tell you they're having a terrifically difficult time hiring people in these fields, not only in science and math, but also in technology. So I would really urge very serious consideration of this proposal. It's critical to Minnesota's future and the nation's.
Chair Pappas, I'd also like to add the issue of the real critical nature of focusing on what is wrong with what's going on with math today. And I came from a recent conference where it was very, very enlightening to hear people don't view themselves as being good at math. Very early on, by third or fourth grade, they're already determining whether they are good at math or not. We did a recent presentation for our Board of Trustees on Normandale's Community College. They brought a student in. He was a non-traditional student. He said, you know, basically I thought I hated math. I was never going to be able to do math. And he said, my faculty, my advisors showed me that math loved me, and he became a math major. So there's a mental image here, but once the mental image is there, a lot of our students just decide, why bother? I'm in a failure mode. What this will do is help us engender more ways that teachers can approach these students and engage them more and in better ways to keep them in a math journey and a math pathway.
Okay. Thanks. Senator Roebling.
I have the original ACHIEVE bill that had the governor's proposal to offer actually a third and fourth year of college tuition free to people who would pursue math and science majors. And even though that's kind of been set aside for now, I'm wondering, now I know you're talking about reaching back maybe into the elementary years and partnering hopefully with the K-12 system, but I'm wondering what you can do more at the college level besides financial incentives to keep more of those students involved in those fields of study, especially the ones that we're looking for to teach math and science. Because I know when they get into our public K-12 system, the financial incentive really isn't there either because everybody's paid the same and they're not allowed to go off the scales usually, and or not scales, but charts or whatever. So I'm wondering what do you think you can do? And you could have $10 million, but would you give it some of it as scholarships, or how are you going to incent these students?
Chair Chancellor Bear,
Chair Pappas, and Senator Roebling, we do intend to do that. We intend to, one, encourage more people to come into the field of teaching, particularly science and math, and that will be partly through some encouragement of some tuition and loan forgiveness once they've completed programs oftentimes. We also have an interesting program we're doing with some business industry folks, including IBM. They have a T2T, transition to teaching program in their corporation, which says as people may be choosing to leave the corporate entity, maybe they're retiring, but maybe they've just decided it's time for a career change, they are encouraging and, in fact, paying some tuition towards those folks completing a degree. So part of this will help us further develop compressed and alternative licensure opportunities for career changers in the field. Those are people who've maybe been out, already done another kind of life of career, and now are really dedicated to getting back and making a difference for students. So that's another thing we'll be doing, as well as bringing better laboratories and simulations and some of the serious gaming opportunities to the curriculum, both in the K-12 as well as in our teacher education programs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Just a comment, and this is going to apply to K-12 too, but if you get those people who were scientists in the field, for example, and they become teachers, how is our pay scale going to accommodate them, or do they start out like first-year teachers?
Vice Chancellor Baer.
Chair Pappas and Senator Roebling, actually, we're expecting they're coming as retired folks with their retirement, and so they come back to dedicate kind of in an altruistic way back to their communities as teachers.
Wow. Okay, any other quick questions? Then Senator Senjum.
Maybe just to tag on a little bit what Senator Roebling has said, and I look at that, and I wonder if you add another couple of zeros, whether or not it would make any difference, and maybe it would with retirees, but it just seems to me fundamentally, I'm not sure what Minskew can do in this area that would be somewhat substantive. When a student graduates a teaching degree, et cetera, you know, math and science, you're going to go out and make $30,000 a year. That isn't going to perhaps compete with a lab tech position at the place where I work. And it just seems to me that, you know, this is probably not the entire answer. We always know that. I just feel somewhat guarded about $10 million into something like this that I'm not sure is going to reap a lot of dividend. It seems to me that you incent people to go into certain careers by virtue of salaries and what that career is. Certainly teaching a noble career, we need all of them. And as somebody said, it's important to our national security, but if it is, then $30,000 a year for beginning a teacher is not appropriate.
Senator Senjum, I think it has to be people who want to teach.
Right.
That's the career they want, not to be a lab tech. And I think that's a very difficult job.
It is.
It's a very difficult job. Very challenging.
Madam Chair, I tried it a long time ago for a week, student teaching, and I knew it wasn't for me.
I did the same thing. It's very challenging.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Thomason.
I used to do a hockey school in the summertime, and it took me 2 days to always say, teachers deserve every day off that they get.
That's because it was in the summertime.
Yeah. President Cuisenaire.
Because I was dealing with kids.
Senator Pappas, I think, too, and this maybe goes beyond what we're proposing here, but I think we need to give some consideration to a program that used to be in existence in some fields, and that's a loan forgiveness program. Many students today go out with considerable debt, and I think that if we could figure out some ways moving forward whereby people who go into these areas could engage in some loan forgiveness for every year that they decided to teach or whatever, might be another incentive to at least keep people moving into the pipeline, even if they were to move out at some point. But I'm optimistic that if they got out and started teaching for 4, 5, 6 years, that by then I think maybe they'll make a career decision, a career choice.
Well, and the governor seems to have a lot of initiatives, K-12 initiatives that have to do with induction and mentoring and all those really important things that someone shall remain nameless has been advocating for a decade. We should do. Senator Lynch.
And thank you, Chair Pappas. And before we conclude, I'll just reiterate that while there is a component of this particular allocation that that speaks to bringing more teachers into those disciplines, there's an equally important component of this allocation that is designed to make sure that students within our Minskew systems are, in fact, attending and getting coursework in those discipline areas that we know are the career paths that are going to address the jobs in the global economy. So this is there's more than one avenue that's being addressed here.
Thanks. Senator Lynch, you want to?
I'd like to entertain a motion to lay Senate File 537 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevailed. Senator Sharon, Senate File 513. I was a little too leisurely in the beginning, so now we actually have to move a little more quickly through our agenda. Put out your fist. And the gang goes, oh, no.
Talk about an area where we need strengthening in the workforce as well in improved career paths.
I'm happy here to introduce the Senate File 513, which is a request for a $3 million appropriation from the general fund to the Board of Trustees for nursing education activities at two-year colleges, including curriculum redesign, program redesign, increasing the number of nursing graduates at the baccalaureate and graduate level, and increasing the number of nurses graduating at the graduate level as well. It's improving retention for underrepresented students in nursing and in allied health fields, and supporting new technology equipment in allied health programs. I would like to say before you begin to ask questions about this bill that I think we should congratulate the MNSCU system because they have, in the year 2005, graduated 3,800 nurses, which was an increase from 2001. And at that time, we were only graduating about 2,186 nursing students. This is a 74% increase in the number of nurses that were graduating. And in between those years, 2001 to 2005, nearly 14,000 nursing students have graduated from the system's institutions. But I'd like to tell you that in preparing for today, I looked at some statistics, and according to the Minnesota Nurses Association, there are nearly 3,600 nursing vacancies in this state, with that number expected to double by 2008. And this shortage is a trend that's not only seen in Minnesota, but at the national and the global level as well. And by the year 2015, it is expected that all 50 states will be experiencing a nursing shortage of some kind. So this appropriation is attempting to address some of the root causes of that problem. The appropriation would increase the number of nursing graduates in high-growth regions and promote retention, which is an important part of this, at the frontline caregiving in long-term care facilities. Funds would be used to design curriculum. It would be used for assisting nursing students who are progressing from other nursing programs into baccalaureate programs and then into graduate degrees, so it's a career pathway program. There is money in this appropriation for simulation-based education and training for caregivers in long-term care facilities. And I can tell you, as a former nurse educator, that one of the backlogs in nursing education has to do with the pressures on the existing systems that provide clinical experiences for nurses, for practicums, and these simulation and laboratory-based training appropriations are critically important throughout the system. And instruction is included in this for electronic medical record technology. This is something that is a skill set that we want to improve in our nurses before they go into the field of practice. So if it is fully funded, The $3 million appropriation would have the following outcomes, which are important to all of us. The number of nursing graduates will increase by 25% over the biennium. So in real numbers, that's 950 nurses. In recruitment and in retention of the underrepresented students in the schools of the allied health fields, which includes nursing and more. And about 1,400 students will be trained on the use of this electronic medical technology systems. And simulation training will be provided to upgrade the skills of workers in about 10 long-term care facilities.
Great. Thank you, Chair. I did have a question, though. How do you interact with the University of Minnesota? How is that going now? Because I remember we had some issues a few years ago over the allied health programs at the U.
Chair Pappas, I'm happy to report that we are meeting on a regular basis about allied health and allied health programming. Some of our testimony regarding the Bioscience Center will reflect our coordinated effort with them in biosciences, but particularly we have been at the table with them constructing what an allied health, statewide allied health approach will be for the state, knowing that we need to have articulated curriculum, meaning that two-year to four-year, four-year to graduate will be in play, but also what new and important emerging fields need to be addressed. So we are working in close partnership with them.
And did you get some money in the base in 2005 for nursing education? So was that not as much as you needed, or you recognized new needs, or?
Chair Pappas, yes, we did, but again, it was a part of a big wave of needs that we need to continue to serve. We did receive some, but we still have waiting lists in our colleges. Also, a shift while we increased by 74% the number of nurses. Many of them were at the two-year level, and our hospitals and care facilities are requiring more of the baccalaureate prepared now. And so that was one of the things that we need to continue to expand upon. So we did have resources. We have distributed that to many different programs. One is a articulated program, particularly in the metropolitan area, so that they're kind of hand in glove. I think when we visited their facility, in fact, the dean there spoke about that.
Senator Sharon, you know, I've heard over the years that after 5 years, 50% of teachers drop out of teaching. Do you know what the figure is for nurses? And is this retention issue, is it a, what do you call it, atmosphere at the workplace, the difficulty of being in hospital nursing, what do you call that?
Stress.
Can't think of a word. Environment. Work environment. Thank you very much.
I think what you're asking me is, and I'm not certain if I can give you any numbers just off the top of my head. Maybe somebody else can, about what the turnover rate is after the first 5 years, or what the dropout rate is in terms of those that are being prepared for the practice. I cannot tell you that. But I know that, that one of the critical factors that are going to be impacting nursing shortage is the retirement of many nurses, those who have stayed in the system, and because they're first employed in the 60s and 70s, they're not going to be staying in the system. So the workforce study that was done by Nursing Management indicates that 55% of the currently employed nurses plan to retire between 2011 and 2020. So that's at the other end. But on the front end, you know, what is, if we're training all these nurses, are we able what is the retention issue, and are we able to do that? Maybe there's somebody else here.
Maybe they just leave the hospital environment because that's the most stressful environment, because it's still a very high-paid job.
Senator Pappas, maybe I could make a few comments here. And as we're looking at retention for nurses, maybe I'm not the one to be speaking right now, because you may know I am a nurse, and I'm your only MNSCU nurse president right now, who obviously still cares a lot about nursing. But I think that the hospitals and long-term care are trying to do some really significant things to help keep people in the field, as I've listened to our director of nursing today. The other thing I'd like to say is we do have some really innovative ways to, I think, help. For instance, right now we've got about 400 associate degree registered nurses on the waiting list that want to be nurses. And we cannot, we have doubled the numbers in our nursing program, but it takes a lot to hire the faculty. The simulators we're talking about are all very expensive. So we do have people in the pipeline, but we don't have the dollars to be able to do the kind of expansion we need. And we need the hospitals, assistance, too, because of the clinical sites
right
there. But we are doing something very interesting that these kind of dollars could help, and that's working with Ember Hills and the other standalone community colleges that have registered nursing programs are working with Metropolitan State University to have a seamless pathway offering upper division classes with our faculty who have got the skill base to help teach in that upper division level to expand those baccalaureate nursing numbers here in Minnesota. So this could really help that.
I think we might have given it to them.
Senator Pappas?
Senator Roebling.
I was just wondering, we had just talked about loan forgiveness for science and math instructors perhaps, but I remember Senator Pretner Solon had a bill 2 years ago, and it was for loan forgiveness for nurses. And it was especially targeted for those who were working in nursing homes, but I think it had a wider application, and I don't think we were able to give it much funding. I don't know who remembers that. It wasn't associated just with MNSCU. It was a general loan forgiveness program. So even if they went to a private college, mm-hmm. that they could use that to help pay off their loans, or the university, any of them. And I'm wondering how much that was, if anybody recalls. And I think we passed part of it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it got what we would have liked to have given it, but we initiated it. And so I don't know if that's in a base somewhere, if it ended up in ours, or
Dr. Weidman's looking it up. Was it in our base?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, that money ended up now in the Health and Human Services base.
Right, so it was through the Health Department.
Okay.
So I think we funded it, but it ended up in their base.
Okay, thank you. And one more quick question on this proposal. Senator Sharon said that it would help fund advancements for workers in 10 nursing homes. Is that what I heard you say? And would they be chosen by grants, or how would that work?
This is the simulation that would, this in reference to the simulation.
Chair Pappas and Senator Roebling, that has to do with expanding what's going on in our entry-level caregivers. It's such a critical area right now, and we're losing people outstate as well as in urban areas. And so our simulators would help in the training so that we would upgrade the quality and the skill levels of those people through simulations.
And I think the question is, how did you figure there would be 10 nursing homes, and do you have like a cohort at these nursing homes that – does some kind of training together, or how does it work?
Chair Pappas, this was actually for us to do some pilots to figure out how we would then push it out from there, and so we would be doing that. This request has also been carefully vetted with our health educators industry partnership group. So if you're wondering where we ended up with our medical electronic transcripting, that came directly from the industry. So many of these things are actually there with industry folks saying, here are our most critical needs.
So Vice Chancellor, when during the last biennium, if we gave you some money to help with the nursing programs, does that then stay? It's in your base. Does that continue on into the next biennium, that whatever you apportioned, I don't remember. Like you said, you did $1 million for underserved populations. Does that roll over?
Chair Pappas, it does, but it isn't automatic to where they've been before, because, as I said, the shift in the industry now is to more baccalaureate. So where the emphasis will be is the 2+2s or the 2+2+2s that are happening, as President Frank commented. So we may be shifting those resources towards more of the baccalaureate, and as well as master's to now our doctorate of nurse practice.
But it stays in the nursing
right.
area.
Yes.
Okay, that was the question. Okay, Senator Sharon, you want to make a motion?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion. Senate file number 513 be laid on the table to be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Latz. Last but not least.
Madam Chair, members, I know we're short for time. I'll be glad to stand for questions.
Spoken like a true ex-House member.
Madam Chair, this is Senate File 535. This is the Bioscience Centers for Excellence Appropriations Bill. This is a small amount in comparison to the other bills being requested, $3 million to create a center of excellence relating to biosciences. I have only a few short points to make, and then we'll allow staff to, or the Minsky system folks to expand on that if they wish. Minsky already has a number of centers of excellence. This would add one, and no, Senator Weger, I'm not trying to put it in my district, even though I could use something from Minsky in my district. Minsky is already doing a lot with biosciences in every substantive category of biosciences throughout their system. This would be an opportunity for them to coordinate that better and to fold it into a more focused strategic initiative. I had two questions when I was briefed on this. One question was, how does this fit in with the University of Minnesota and Mayo's biosciences initiative? We, you know, a lot of us attended the biosciences conference and learned all about the exciting things that are going on in the biosciences field. And the question was answered directly by Dr. Frank Serra at an event in which he said, we're doing all this research and stuff, but we need someone to make the products, the actual workers, to produce the products that are going to be generated by all of the research. And that has been a terrific function that MinSKU has provided so well in Minnesota in so many different areas. We need highly skilled people who can produce the products that are going to be generated by the biosciences research going on in Minnesota. And the other question I had was, particularly, is there a geographic location that is anticipated for this? And the answer was no, the same way that they decided where to locate and how to focus their other centers of excellence. MinSKU would be doing an assessment of the entire system, all of the opportunities, the options, the strengths that exist in various parts of the system right now, and somewhere down the road we'd make some decisions about where to physically locate this center of excellence. So I don't think I need to sell the committee on the importance of biosciences. This would be MinSKU's special contribution to making it work overall in the state.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Are there any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator St. John.
Madam Chair and Senator, or perhaps your guests, I'm looking at the write-up on here, and it certainly does speak to healthcare, manufacturing, applied engineering. I'm wondering, though, an element of biosciences is in the state is certainly agricultural biosciences, and even beyond that, I suppose, the biosciences somewhat agriculturally related that deal with renewables. Conceivably, could this center and what it does target, if a college were to so choose, those areas, basically the areas of ag and renewable?
Vice Chancellor Baer.
Chair Pappas and Senator St. John, yes, what you were referencing were our former our existing centers to date, our manufacturing, engineering, healthcare, and our computer information and security center. This is a very important point for our state right now. We believe that our system is the only system in the nation offering degrees in every facet of the biosciences, as you're mentioning, biotechnology, medical devices, nanotechnology, the renewable energy side of it. And not only that, these are strong programs with national reputation. And so what this center would allow us to do now is to coordinate and put some resources behind this so that we could further work with the business industry folks. And so energy, I think, was your main question. Yes, energy is included in this.
Thank you.
Senator Latz or Vice Chancellor, do you already have a site for a bioscience center? Has that already been determined?
Chair Pappas, there is no site designated. The last time we did a very robust set of RFPs where we brought industry in to begin with to describe and converse with our campuses interested in proposing a center, what the industry needed from us if we were creating centers of excellence for this new century. And so no place has been decided. It would go through the same kind of RFP process it did last time.
Okay, any other questions? Well, we know this is a really important area. Our committee was at a bioscience conference just last week, and there's been a lot of discussion, certainly, of the importance of research in this area. So, and it's been kind of interesting to see what you've done with your centers of excellence when we saw the whole display at Metro State. A lot of variety, a lot of different innovative is the word of the day, I guess, and creative work.
Well, Chair Pappas, we appreciate them very much, and we are pleased to be able to report to you the kind of innovation that's going on, the partnerships, K-12, business industry, colleges and universities, to really make the state stronger.
Great. Thanks. Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 535 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thanks very much. Okay, we're going to go now to the governor's budget recommendations. Senator Roebling, if you want to join Ms. Hegard and Mr. Kanis. And this is the one we want to save, right?
Well, you got to plant it.
This Senate File 575, members, I want you to keep these in your packet. The others you don't have to, but because we're going to come back to this bill.
Right.
we're only going to be looking at the Minsky section, but we will be looking at other sections at different points. And in your budget books, it's right at the beginning of the book, the governor's recommendations.
Tina, just come back to your housekeeping bill.
Yeah, if we don't get to it. Okay. Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 575 is the governor's budget proposal for Minsky, and it includes a $123 million increase from the previous biennium. Part of that is one-time money, and part of that would be going into the base type of money. And it combined, though, it's a 10.4% overall increase in the Minsky budget. And so if you look at that whole $123 million, you could say that it would cover pretty much all of the inflation that is estimated by Minsky at 3.25% inflation, because that would take $130 million to do that. But the governor isn't targeting just that. He has a number of strategic initiatives in here that Minsky has asked for, and all of the members who have been up here today with their budget requests on certain bills should be happy to know that a number of them are funded in this initiative. For example, the one that Senator Wieger was talking about, he was requesting $24 million for programs for underrepresented and underserved students. The governor does have $12 million in here. Senator Sharon was asking for $3 million. The governor does have $3 million. Senator Latz was asking for $10 million, and there's $3 million in here. Senator Lynch was asking for $10 million for the STEM program, and there's $10 million in here. And the bill that Senator Corin is going to introduce on the management innovations, there's $10 million in here, and $10 million is requested.
Could I just ask what this is that just got passed out? Because I'm kind of confused.
Madam Chair, this was just a sheet that we prepared in our office that we thought we'd walk folks through.
Okay.
If
so
you're
that's right.
That.
If you're going to do that, then I'll hold my confusion.
Senator Clark had her bill for $70 million, and there's $60 million total in the governor's proposal, $45 million the first year and one-time money, and $15 million ongoing. And then there's $25 million one-time bonus appropriation in here, which we haven't heard about yet, which I think we'll cover briefly as we can. So those are bonuses for meeting goals. And so I think we'll turn it over to Susan Hegard from the Office of Higher Education to explain further the initiative.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for allowing us to have some time before you today. I'll just start off by saying that the governor is very pleased with Minsky's strategic plan and with the budget requests that they made in general. I think that he met with the chancellor and board members several times and expressed his pleasure with the direction that they've been moving to them directly. He recognizes, I think, that there's a key role that Minsky plays in the workforce development of the state. I mean, if you note some of our presentations, I think we've shown you, at least back at our office, that Minsky educates most students attend Minsky's two-year schools. They educate a vast number of students in this state. I visited about two-thirds of the Minsky campus so far. I'm still working my way through the list, but I've seen lots of progress being made across the state. This proposal, I think, provides some new resources to help support the strategic direction of the system and further implementation of the plan, focused really on retaining and recruiting students, meeting workforce needs, and updating the technology infrastructure. I'll walk quickly through the budget. We have a sort of a cheat sheet that we handed out. I don't know if you'll find that helpful, but it's what I'd like to work from if you're okay with that. There's an 8.3% increase for the biennium for Minsky, and if you include the one-time money, it's 10.4%. So this one-page piece of paper that I handed out, $98 million overall for 08 and 09, and there's $25 million in one-time money, and I'll walk you through this. The first piece that you've heard about today, the Access, Opportunity, and Success programs, the governor funded that at half Minsky's request.
I think he recognizes that Minsky was an access point, the first access point for many of these students. One of the things that I'd like to note, though, is that I think we're looking internally at the administration, but also it might make some sense for the legislature to take a look at all the programs that are out there now. You know, ought this to be something that's more centrally focused? Should it be more dispersed? Because I know the U has interest in these programs. The Private College Council does as well, and MNSCU now. Should there be some standard criteria that's looked at? I just think that if you want to know how the money's being used, and as Senator Cohen said, money's fungible, and you want to make sure that it's going to its intended purpose, you might want to think about that with this targeted money towards disadvantaged students. The Center of Excellence, that's funded at $3 million. That's consistent with MNSCU's request. The governor had been very supportive of their efforts on the initial four centers of excellence. He had initially requested $20 million. Money that was ultimately appropriated was $10 million, and there were four centers. I think some good progress is being made at those centers, and he was interested in supporting this one as well. I think making sure, though, as Senator Latz pointed out, that it's complementary to what the University of Minnesota is doing and not, you know, competitive. We want to make sure that it's a good fit, and we know that there's some workforce needs that MNSCU can perform in that area. In terms of the allied health, the governor funded that at the full request. There's been some wonderful partnerships going on between the U and MNSCU and others around the state. That one of the centers of excellence has focused on the allied health area at Winona, and so that is something that the governor is very pleased with. In terms of technology, the governor funded close to 85% of that request in the first biennium at $60 million. You're correct in noting that the money does taper off, and I think the governor will be open to discussing additional revenue in the future, but I think he wants to see how this money is spent before that discussion occurs, before the money's bumped up again. So we understand that the system's concerned about the tapering off of some of that revenue, but I think he felt that it was important to at least try to come as close to their recommendation as he could.
So can you just say, of the $60 million, would you remind me again how much of that is one time?
There's 45 in the first year, and then there's 15 in the second year of the biennium. And of that, what's one time? That's all ongoing. The 15.
So 30 million in the base.
Correct. 30 in the base is ongoing. I'm sorry. I think they're going to be several criticisms, obviously, of the budget. One is going to be that overall the money doesn't fully meet the system's request. I guess I would just note, I've heard the governor talk about this and others, that in the healthcare HHS budget alone, the growth is predicted to be around 13% without any reforms or new programs. Mm-hmm. So in order to be mindful of changing demographics and that sort of thing, you know, across state government, not every area is going to be able to get the money that it wants. And so in the higher education area, the governor's provided, I think, overall $300 million for higher education, excluding the GI Bill. And for each system, he's tried to come, I think, close to $100 million in funding. So one request will be the overall money. The second request, I think, will be the lack of money, as you see here in the sheet, for inflation. There was zero provided by the governor for that. And I think, you know, really the best answer I can give is that this is the beginning of a process. There are lots of interests. It's now your turn at the legislature to work with the money. But I think he felt it was his job to try to target that money strategically, consistent with the way that the system had put their budget forward. And then finally, I think there'll obviously be some criticism of the one-time money. I think the governor tried to have ongoing money where he could, and then where it seemed like there was one-time money that was appropriate, that was where he targeted those funds. The performance bonus is something that's new in your bill, the big bill on page, what is it on, 7 and 8. I think it lays out the criteria for this performance bonus. We talked with the system while we were developing this proposal. One of the concerns I'd had is, will this get sort of tangled up with the accountability work that we've been doing with you that's statewide? And what ended up happening is that we worked with the system on trying to tie this to their internal system indicators, and they were willing to move forward with us on this. You need to meet, three of the five indicators, and these are all MNSCU indicators. And then by October 1st of 2007, the board and the Office of Higher Education must agree on the numerical indicators and definitions for each of the five goals that will be used to demonstrate attainment of each goal. So they'll work with our office
on these performance indicators.
Ms. Teagard and Senator Roebling, I apologize that we're kind of rushed with you, but we know you're going to be back because we do want to have MNSCU respond to the governor's budget. We have also the MNSCU housekeeping bill that's probably going to be our vehicle bill for the omnibus bill, and we also know we're going to be talking to the Office of Higher Education about your initiatives. So I think I do want to spend some more time looking at the performance bonus section in light of our accountability work that we have. Remember, members, we have an accountability workshop that we're doing the last Friday of the month, I believe.